Now, the one who protects us all from prattling prognosticators and perfidious pundits.
I say, America, stay out the bushes.
Look for the union label.
To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government.
From my cold, dead hands.
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected.
It's time for the Alan Nathan Show. Here he is, the longest-running nationally syndicated centrist host in the country, Alan Nathan.
Welcome, everyone, to the Alan Nathan Show, the gigafactory of militant moderation, where we want the Republicans out of our bedrooms, the Democrats out of our wallets, and both out of our First and Second Amendment rights. I'm your host today, John Hayward, National Security Editor with Breitbart News. Please be sure to visit our website at alannathan.com for our podcasts and our showtimes. A little Tesla joke there, the Gigafactory is what Tesla calls their gigantic factory complexes. Tesla's an interesting company, of course, Elon Musk, running the show there, very big, controversial figure. You're going to hear a lot more about Tesla, I would predict. It's become a political football in a lot of ways because, you know, it's the only company that's really making money domestically doing electric cars. China is the other dominant electric car producer, electric vehicle producer. Everybody else tried. You know, all the big automakers, Ford, Chevy, you name it, they all did electric cars and then some. They spent titanic amounts of money. They got fabulously huge taxpayer subsidies during the Obama years, and they're all disasters. Nobody wants any of them. Tesla is the only one that's making any money. But of course, when Elon Musk signed up with the Trump administration and became the head of the Department of Government Efficiency, he suddenly became an enemy of the left. They hate him now. So they were attacking Tesla's they're blowing up Tesla dealerships, whatever it took, you know, to show their hatred of Elon Musk for throwing in with Trump. Kind of an early warning, I think, if you needed another early warning, that the left is becoming increasingly crazy and violent during these years. And everything they do now is an expression of their blind rage and a will to destroy rather than to build anything constructively. But the other reason you're going to hear more about Tesla is that quite a battle is shaping up here for the coming year leading up to the midterm elections between socialism and capitalism. And you're going to get a preview of that, I guess you call it the title fight, coming up soon, because Zohra Mamdani, the socialist, communist, globalized, the Intifada guy, who won mayor of New York City in the last election, is going to talk with President Trump next week, supposedly. They're going to meet, if that all goes ahead. And everybody on both sides is chomping at the bit for this meeting to take place. Now, Mamdani and his supporters, including the far left of the Democrat Party, they all think that he's getting elevated by having this meeting. The very fact that it's going to happen is unusual because he's just the mayor-elect of a city, granted New York, a very big city, but he's the mayor-elect of a city. And it's a little unusual for the president to elevate someone like that to his stature with a face-to-face meeting. So they're taking this as great news for him and, you know, basically showing that he is now the leader, presumptive leader of the Democratic Party. He's the face of it. And they're hot to trot for that because he's young and he's upbeat and he won in New York and they think he's going to make socialism look great and he's going to win. Now, of course, if you're the other side, if you're Trump and his supporters and Republicans, they're salivating at the idea of making Mamdani the head of the Democratic Party because they think he's a nut. And a lot of the stuff that he promised during his campaign was ridiculous and he's going to fall on his face and New York is going to be a disaster. And then they're going to wrap him around the necks of the Democratic Party and sink them to the bottom of the ocean. So they're kind of looking forward to elevating him. They're doing the Democrats dirty in a way by making him the new face of the entire party and brooming aside its experienced leadership. And, you know, behind the scenes, politically, in the smoke-filled rooms that you hear about all the time, where a lot of the sharp operators live, people aren't super ideological. They're just hired guns for the party, and they want the party to win. One of the things that you hear in these back rooms is that Democrats are making a mistake not unlike what happened to the Tea Party. Remember the Tea Party back in the Obama years? They were one of the great grassroots success stories of modern politics, came out of nowhere, became huge, genuine grassroots movement. Ordinary people, working people, were going out of their way to join demonstrations for the Tea Party like nothing anybody had ever seen before. But the Republican establishment didn't like them. The Democrat establishment most assuredly did not like them. They called them terrorists. And they had a couple years in the sun. And then their movement kind of sputtered out and was destroyed. And still, it's not entirely dead. A lot of enthusiastic Tea Party people are now enthusiastic Trump supporters. But the Tea Party as a discrete force pretty much came to naught. And one of the big reasons why it came to ruin was that the people in the Tea Party did not have a lot of experience at politics. I mean, they were a grassroots movement. They were mom and pop activists, and they didn't know, they didn't have plug-in access to the political system. They didn't have these old pros that had been around forever working for them. And it turns out you do kind of need that stuff. And if you're a young activist type that's really into a movement like this, you don't like the establishment of your party. And good heavens, I can't blame anybody for not liking the Republican establishment. You know, you don't like the establishment of your party. And the Tea Party was pretty openly disdainful of the rhinos and the old guard and everything. And it was mutual. The old guard didn't like them. And the old guard was able to prevent the Tea Party from having these professional services, consultants, well-established networks were not working for them. And man, it was pretty devastating. You know, the Tea Party ran some people that were not great candidates. The whole movement was caricatured by being stapled to these people that were offbeat and kooky. And the whole thing pretty much died after that. And there are those in these smoke-filled rooms, the analyst types, who are saying the Democrats are making basically the same mistake with people like Mamdani and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Often comes up in these discussions. They're young, and they're supposed to be filled with energy, and they're populists, they're left-wing populists, and populism is only supposed to be evil when right-wingers do it. When left-wingers do it, it's fine. So they're populist types, but they don't have experience. They don't have the old guard behind them. And in fact, they don't like the old guard. You know, and the old guard would be the likes of Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, who has been marginalized and put out to pasture about as fast as I think I've ever seen a powerful character get hustled out the door. I mean, this guy is basically a non-entity now. He's faded into oblivion ever since the shutdown, which, according to the insiders, he didn't want to do. Chuck Schumer was not crazy about the shutdown. He didn't think it was going to work. Most of the old guard pros in the Democratic Party thought it was a bad idea, but the young hotheads really wanted to show they could fight Donald Trump and do a shutdown, and it didn't go well for the Democrats, really. The only reason it hasn't hurt them more is that the entire conversation shifted rapidly to Jeffrey Epstein, which is also hurting the Democrats in some way, but you got to give them this much. It got people to stop talking about their shutdown disaster, and it's also preventing people from talking about the stuff that Donald Trump really needs to talk about, and you got to call that a win. But Schumer is basically out to the cow pasture. He's off to the glue factory. A lot of the old guard Democrats are out. And you're going to see these younger, hot-headed activist types like Mamdani making the same mistake, the theory goes, as the Tea Party. They're going to have no support from the old guard, and it's really going to hurt them. So we shall see. But for President Trump, this meeting with Mamdani is not just a way to focus on a Democrat who is not going to be popular anywhere but the place he got elected, that's going to be repellent to nationwide voters, because that's a safe bet. But the other reason it's good for Trump is that it refocuses him on the economy. And one of the big knocks on President Trump right now, including from a lot of people that support him, is that he's been so tied up in foreign affairs. He's been out of the country. All he's working on is peace in the Middle East and stuff. And he's very happy with his achievements there. You know, and future historians may well say Trump did some amazing things on the foreign stage. But that does not win elections. Especially not midterm elections. There are not too many times when foreign policy has been the tiebreaker and the deal maker in elections in America, and this probably isn't going to be one of them. And especially in an off-year election where the opposition party has the wind at its back and people are thinking about domestic affairs, they're talking about the economy and so forth. That's what they want to hear about. And if Trump is out there touting his latest peace deal overseas, that's not the focus that people want. So here comes Trump and Mamdani, and that is pretty obviously going to work to reposition the White House to talk about domestic affairs and the economy and jobs. A new job report just came out, and it's kind of weird because this is the jobs report for September. So it was delayed because of the government shutdown. There probably won't be one for October because that's just going to disappear entirely. And then the November one is going to be late. They say the November one's going to be like in the middle of the month because of all the shutdown disruptions. But the September one finally came out, and it was spectacular. It was easily 2 to 3 times as many jobs created as the professionals were all anticipating. A lot of people going back to work, a lot of jobs moving. That's something Trump wants to talk about. is a good job market. And I'll tell you, one of the things that Trump could talk about, and it's going to take some courage, we're probably going to come back to this and talk about it some more later. It's going to take some guts, and it's the kind of guts that I think Donald Trump has, so he might very well do it. But one of the things to talk about here is how much of this is the swift and immediate benefit of cracking down on illegal aliens. I mean, you're not supposed to talk about this in American politics. It's considered very rude to talk about the cost and the deleterious effect of mass migration. But the reason a lot of jobs are appearing and wages are going up is because the illegals are gone. And now they have to hire Americans. And that's going to continue to have a salutary effect on the job market. And the left is going to lose their minds if Trump talks about that during his big pivot to the economy. So we will see if he sticks to that strategy. I'm John Hayward, your host today. We'll be right back with more of the Alan Nathan Show.
Next year marks America's 250th birthday. And what better way to celebrate than an elevated train journey through the American Southwest? Canyon Spirit offers the adventure of a lifetime with scenic train journeys through rugged canyons and desert landscapes, along with gourmet dining and world-class service. Expansive panoramic windows allow guests to watch the magnificent scenery best seen by rail, including river canyons, red rocks, and more. Canyon Spirit travels between Salt Lake City and Denver with overnight stays in Moab, Utah, and Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And the train only travels during the day, allowing guests to enjoy the journey and relax overnight in charming small towns. TV host and travel expert Kelly Rizzo.
I think there's a certain romance to boarding a train, especially through the iconic vistas of the Southwest. Canyon Spirit offers a front row seat to these breathtaking wonders along with historic storytelling and regionally inspired gourmet dining. It's truly a wondrous experience.
To learn more, visit canyonspirit.com.
Butterball, the best known and most loved brand of turkey in the U.S., has partnered with renowned ChefCorp brand Headley and Bennett to create the first ever Thanksgiving hosting pans. Butterball turkey talk line expert Corey Gustavik shares more.
Roasting whole turkey isn't something most of us do every day. It can be intimidating and stressful, but the right clothes can make you feel more confident and comfortable in the kitchen. That's why Butterball created the first of their kind Thanksgiving hosting pants. Designed with a fun turkey print in Butterball blue, these pants are sure to give you swagger in the kitchen while keeping all your cooking essentials within arm's reach. With custom pockets for your meat thermometer and phone, loops for your utensils and towels, and a bottle opener to keep the party hydrated, these pants will help you get a leg up in your hosting duties this year. Butterball is giving away for free one final time while supplies last at noon Eastern this Monday, November 17th.
Learn more and claim your pair of hosting pants at ThanksgivingHostingPants.com.
Adopt U.S. Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve! It's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned, accessible homes and vehicles, and access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs. at pva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor with Breitbart News. President Trump had a big meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, at the White House. He had some contentious exchanges with the press, but he also announced some big deals with the Saudis, including a lot of investment in the United States, and did not announce something that I think the White House is really hoping for, which would be Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords and normalizing relations with Israel. Here with us to sum up the meeting is Megan Mobbs, Director of the Center for American Safety and Security at the Independent Women's Forum. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
This is a big meeting between Trump and bin Salman, and it was a very big move for the Saudi crown prince because he has been in somewhat bad odor with the Western world ever since the death of Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed by Saudi agents in Istanbul back in 2018. And he's been on the outs ever since then. And this was pretty much his return party and a way of saying that's over. Which Trump pretty explicitly said when the press brought it up and said, how can you have this guy sitting here after he killed Khashoggi? And Trump yelled at him and said, you can't prove he had anything to do with it, and that's not the story anymore. So this was the prince turning a page and Saudi Arabia becoming a force diplomatically and economically in the Western world again.
I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, we can lament what happened over Khashoggi, and we can also recognize that in some ways this meeting signaled a complete return to what I would call hard-nosed realism. It truly suggests that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is going to be viewed primarily through the lens of deterrence, in particular China and the Gulf, energy stability, and great power competition. And to your point earlier, there was this massive investment that was announced, more than $600 billion, which was the original announcement, all the way up to $1 trillion of investment here in the United States. And so I think that's really the lens through which the president is looking, and through the lens we should all be thinking is more around that, a return to the world as it really is, and how can we better impact American security by making these necessary alliances or arrangements?
There's an old saying that nations don't really have friends or allies, they have interests. And when you build a relationship based on interests, it's sturdy, and you can predict it will last because everybody is interested in making it work. And this was an example of that. Saudi Arabia has things the U.S. wants and needs. We have things they want and need, like our nuclear energy technology. That was a big thing. Here, defense, weapons, they wanted a security arrangement with us, which they're going to get. We want Saudi investment. We want Saudi uranium, which is going to be part of the nuclear deal. This was all very rational, as you say, very, very hard-nosed, very cold-eyed, but also sustainable. This is how you build a relationship that holds up.
That's exactly right. And I think it's okay to acknowledge it's transactional. I think that there is absolutely a place for moral clarity. Again, I think that we can be very clear-eyed and say that, you know, what happened with a Saudi journalist is certainly not something that we would condone, while also saying that the interests of Americans in America, particularly in the Gulf, has to be this long-term regional security arrangement, in particular as China looks to the Gulf area, trying to build their relationships there. We simply cannot afford that, both literally and metaphorically. And so the efforts by the Trump administration to secure that critical partnership, to ensure that the kingdom is seen as the most, arguably the most critical anchor of regional security in the Gulf, it was a necessary step.
The energy secretary a couple days ago almost explicitly said that if we don't make this nuclear tech deal with Saudi Arabia, China and Russia will, because they want their nuclear power, and they have good reasons for wanting it. You might think Saudi Arabia, they're floating on a sea of oil. Why do they want nuclear power? Well, they want to transition away from oil, but the more interesting reason is desalinization. Nuclear desalinization is far more efficient. Saudi Arabia needs purified water, drinking water, and they'll be a water superpower with American nuclear technology. So this is something they really need. And if they didn't get it from us, they were going to get it from somebody else.
That's exactly right. And that's also part of the Kingdom's Vision 2030 plan, which we do see as an opportunity for us to expand U.S. investment. But that also, again, enriches us. It also enriches Saudi Arabia. And it allows us to, and part of that Vision 2030 put forward by Saudi Arabia is to move away from exactly what you said before, just being a pure oil state and beginning to diversify their economic stability and to do some social changes that they recognize they must monitor in order to be critical partners with the West. Southwest. So all that to say, you're exactly right. And that's where we should be, encouraging those modernizations, encouraging those social changes, while also recognizing that there is an economic partnership that also helps us deter China and Russia and is in the long-term interest of the United States of America.
Now, Saudi Vision 2030, that's Mohammed bin Salman's reform package. I first read it when it first came out years ago. Very ambitious plan. And it's a great example of what you're talking about, that there are practical reasons that inspired reforms in Saudi Arabia. For many years, you had people saying, hey, they're backwards, they're medieval, they need to change, they need to treat their women better. And it got everybody exactly nowhere. But then Mohammed bin Salman comes along and says, I want to attract foreign investment to Saudi Arabia. I need money in here. And that means we're going to have to stop being a medieval theocracy. And boom, they started actually implementing meaningful reforms.
That's exactly right. Now, are the reforms perfect? Is it as much as we would morally like to see? No, of course not. But change takes time. And they're also never going to be a Jeffersonian democracy. It's just not going to happen. So this goes back to the president's kind of understanding of the world as it is, again, encouraging that change, that move towards, in particular, rights for women, which is critically important to the U.S. as a moral leader in that area. And the administration has actually been a huge champion of women's rights, even here domestically, as he signaled, you know, the return to acknowledging biological sex. So we want Saudi Arabia to move towards those changes, but that should not, and it has not, prevented us from also recognizing the necessary security partnership that has to be kind of prominent and preeminent in that relationship.
Now, what Trump didn't get, at least not yet, is Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords, which were a huge success when Trump first kicked them off during his first term. Then they went completely inert during the Biden years. The Biden administration had no interest in them. And now they're back, and Kazakhstan has joined the Abraham Accords. But Trump really wanted a big name, and I think he wanted either or both Saudi Arabia and Syria, and he didn't get either one of them, at least not this week. And Saudis pretty much explicitly said they're not going to join until the Palestinians are on the path to statehood. Where do you see that going from here? Is there a realistic chance that they will join the Accords in the near future?
So I think there's always a realistic chance, because I do think that Saudi Arabia recognizes that kind of peace in the Middle East is going to be part of that is going to be having a relationship with Israel. I mean, if you remember the first Trump administration, everybody said the Abraham Accords were impossible. It was never going to happen. And to your point earlier, look, you can see where we are today, how important they have been for that peace process. And again, it's going to take time. I don't think this is something that's going to happen overnight. We saw the UN vote earlier this week that it basically endorsed the 20-point plan that the president put forward for peace. And so I think that there is a chance of this happening. And quite frankly, a chance is a lot better than we were just a few years ago about this possibility. And I think where possible, the president is going to use a stick and a carrot approach to get there. So I would say I think it's possible. I don't know if I would give a good probability on it as of right now.
I've heard behind-the-scenes chatter for a lot of years that there are people in Saudi Arabia that really want to do business with Israel and normalize. They see a lot of benefits there, but it's just culturally impossible for them with the Palestinian question ongoing. And meanwhile, I thought Sharaa from Syria was an interesting display there, because he sounded like he wasn't really opposed to the Abraham Accords. And this is a guy that used to belong to Al-Qaeda. His big gripe was that as long as the Israelis have troops on Syrian soil, it's no soap until they pull away from that. And that's realistic. I'll give you the last word. Do you think Syria might be climbing on board?
I think they may as well. I think that, to your point earlier, there have been massive changes in the Middle East, and I think that we should always be hopeful that the president is going to push for exactly that.
Megan Mobbs, director of the Center for American Safety and Security at the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks very much for joining us today. I'm John Hayward, deputy national security editor for Breitbart News, your host today. We'll be right back with more of the Alan Nathan Show.
Hilton has once again been ranked number one on the world's best workplace list, according to Great Place to Work and Fortune. The hospitality leader has now topped the list twice in 3 years. At Hilton, its team members say the hospitality industry is where they can learn, grow, and achieve their career goals. Victoria, a sales director at a Homewood Suites property, explains.
Hospitality is the warmest industry that you can go into. The care, the nurturing, and the areas of opportunity are large. There are so many different elements in hospitality, and I don't think everyone thinks about the larger picture that they could fit into. Hilton has always been just a welcoming, open-armed, flexible place to work. I'm going to look forward in enjoying more stable work days and the ability to just have that work-life balance that I truly want.
To learn more about what makes Hilton a great place to work, visit stories.hilton.com/world's best workplace.
Small businesses face constant security challenges, from protecting property to keeping employees and customers safe. Simply Safe is stepping in with a new suite of professional-grade security solutions designed specifically for business owners. TV host and entrepreneur Chip Wade has more.
As a business owner, I travel a lot for work, and it's reassuring to have a system that not only lets me monitor my businesses no matter where I am, but it's protected by trained agents who will intervene if there's trouble. It's about knowing my offices and workshops are protected even when I can't be there.
Simply Safe Business Security offers customizable plans backed by 24/7 monitoring. Key features include AI-powered cameras, live agents who can help prevent crimes and call for help in an emergency, multi-camera live streaming, customized user access, and elevated customer support.
Simply Safe aims to give business owners just like me peace of mind so they can focus on growing their businesses, all without long-term contracts or cancellation penalties.
To learn more, visit simplysafe.com.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show. If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
The forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon?
Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. The latest data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that the population of foreign-born persons in the United States is declining, but the research from the Center for Immigration Studies says it's declining even more sharply than the BLS data shows, and a profound shift in the underlying American economy and culture could be in the offing. Here with us to talk about it is Dr. Steve Camerata, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Thank you for having me on.
I feel like this is the big story that isn't being told yet, and I know the mainstream press does not want to tell this story, but quite frankly, an awful lot of people who weren't supposed to be here are gone, and those numbers are so huge that it's beginning to shift the economy, the job market, wages, everything is starting to change because of President Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration.
Yeah, no, I mean, the data is pretty compelling. If we look at this monthly data that the Bureau of Labor Statistics collects, it shows likely through September. Now, we don't have – everything hasn't been released, and we can't do our own analysis. We can only look at the published numbers. But what they seem to indicate is it's possible that since President Trump took office, the total foreign-born is down about 2.3 million just January to September. And of that, probably about three-fourths are illegal immigrants, so somewhere around 1.7 million decline in the illegal immigrant population.
I mean, that is staggering. That's a huge number achieved more rapidly than anyone would have thought possible. And another bit of anecdotal evidence I noticed today is that Charlotte, North Carolina, the school district over there, they said that 30,000 of their students are gone, which means a lot of them, most of them, were illegal alien kids that have been pulled out of the school, either because their parents have been deported or because they're afraid to send the kids out because they might catch the attention of immigration. 30,000 kids. There goes your school overcrowding. There goes your school budget being stretched to the breaking point. There goes all the problems we were having with overpacked classrooms.
No, that's a great point. Look, there are many reasons to enforce immigration laws. The rule of law is one of them. Obviously, getting rid of criminal aliens has always got to be a priority. But there were some more basic reasons, like taking pressure off of schools and hospitals. In addition, things such as taking pressure off the bottom end of the labor market so American workers
make more money and have higher rates of employment. And so people often, I think, put way too much emphasis on, the criminal aliens. But there was a lot more to it than that.
Sure. Now, the new report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is out for the job market, and it was, I think, two or three times as many jobs created as the experts were expecting. And some of that, I believe, is probably due to the removal of illegal aliens from the job market.
Right. So what we have is information showing that it looks like, but we have to be cautious about this. We haven't done our own analysis, and there's some caveats about this. But it looks like that the native-born are gaining a lot of jobs as the immigrant population declines in the United States, which is exactly what we would hope for in the context of robust immigration enforcement.
Now, for all these years, we've been told this mantra that these are jobs Americans don't want to do, that if we don't bring in aliens to do them, they won't get done. And that just does not seem to be true.
No, very fair point. Very fair point. Look, there are several things. One is, look, the border, it has nothing to do with our policies. It's just conditions in sending countries. And that's why people are showing up. And, of course, that was never true. And recent events have shown how wrong that was. The second thing was, look, okay, maybe you can control the border. But you can't make people go home. Once they're here, they're staying. But that doesn't seem to be true either. It's basically the best evidence we have. And then finally, we were always told, look, these are jobs Americans won't do. But that ignored all the evidence that most of the workers doing all the unpleasant work in the United States, with maybe one or two exceptions, whether it's nannies, maids, busboys, roofers, you name it, cab drivers, most of the people who do those jobs are U.S. born. How can you say it's a job Americans won't do when most of the people who do them are U.S. born? If you want to attract more Americans into those jobs, you got to pay higher wages. You got to treat people better. And one of the things always short-circuiting that process was very high levels of immigration generally.
That's one of the things that's always bothered me about this, between illegal aliens and then legal systems that have been abused, like the now infamous H-1B visas and so on. All of this is basically a cheat that's telling us that the system that was devised for American citizens doesn't really work. The economy that our elites have built is a phony dog and pony show, and the only way to make it work is to bring in people from other countries that will work for lower wages and got educated in a different way than Americans did.
Look, I mean, you can blame both parties for this. The Republicans have been far too captive to business interests and whatever the business community tells them. We can't find anybody. Americans don't want to work. Those kinds of arguments, rather than the Republicans saying, okay, we get that. If we're going to fix those problems, we have to have the jobs and we have to have better wages and conditions and working conditions. And on the left, which are supposed to be so concerned about working class and lower income people, they tend to have put in more emphasis on the immigrants and bringing in ever more foreign workers without any regard to the impact on the constituencies they supposedly speak for. That is, the less educated and lower income populations. So both parties were to blame for an immigration system, whether it's not enforcing the law or bringing in millions of legal immigrants. Remember, there are about 38 million legal immigrants in the United States. So legal immigration is enormous, and both parties are responsible for that.
And that's a difficult conversation to have. It's one thing to talk about illegal aliens, although the left doesn't even want to do that, and they tell us we can't even use those words. But when it comes to legal immigrants, most Americans want legal immigration, and they're sympathetic to people who have done it right, to the law-abiding people who followed the system. But it is still possible to have too much legal immigration, and that still does have deleterious effects.
Right. I mean, look, everybody said, look, if somebody comes here legally, they deserve treated with dignity and respect, and if they want to become a citizen, this is for the permanent resident anyway, which is about 1.2 million new people each year, they should be able to do that. But the question is that 1.2 million, does that make sense? Does it make sense to select those people primarily based on their family relationships rather than skills and ability to contribute to the economy? That does not mean that the illegal immigrants are lazy or they come to get welfare or that they don't work. It just means that a very large fraction have relatively little education, and that has consequences. Do we want to add to the low-income population with our legal immigration policy? And then, of course, an extremely large fraction of illegal immigrants have very modest levels of education. So that adds to our low-income population, too. It's why when we just look at the straight data that the government collects, more than half of all immigrant households, and it's similar for illegal immigrants and legal immigrants, it's all roughly the same, not totally the same, but use one of the major welfare programs, whether it's WIC or food stamps or the earned income tax credit or cash payments of other kinds. So, there's a real consequence. And employers love this situation. They get to hold down wages and get the workers they want. But if you had to put it in a bumper sticker, there's a high cost to cheap labor. And none of this has anything to do with criminal aliens, which we could discuss. But the reasons to have a modest level of immigration isn't just because some immigrants are criminals. And unfortunately, too many Republicans talk that way.
And when you talk about criminals, one of the big stories on that thing going out right now is the Transportation Department is pointing out how many illegal alien truck drivers are driving around illegally, and they're killing people. They're causing fatal car accidents because they don't know the rules of the road and they can't drive properly. They just busted a guy from Uzbekistan who had something like 5 different driver's licenses from different states that were all fraudulently issued to this guy. He shouldn't have had one. He was an illegal alien. And the Transportation Department is saying, what the hell is going on here? These state governments are out of control and they're putting American lives at risk by handing out driver's licenses to these illegals.
Yeah, I mean, I would just put it this way. Once you start tolerating widespread illegal immigration, it's a very short step to tolerating all kinds of other violations of other regulations. Because when you teach people that the rule of law doesn't matter, that the rules, hey, you can ignore them, you're going to have cascading consequences for society. And one of them we've seen is now these untrained truck drivers who've committed horrific accidents, have caused horrific. That's exactly right. And I think that that's just one of the reasons why you want to enforce the law. And that is because law matters. Order in society matters. And widespread toleration of illegal immigration undermines that fundamental foundation of society.
You mentioned how the pressure off hospitals is going to be lifted by the illegal immigration being cracked down upon, and that's going to change the healthcare discussion because we just had this big government shutdown over the fact that Obamacare is dying, the Democrats don't want to admit it, but it's in free fall, and they have to pump another $1 trillion in subsidies into it to get it to work. An awful lot of that is because of illegal aliens that are draining the healthcare system and filling up the hospitals and inflicting costs that have to be passed on in other ways.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Obviously, I do know a fair amount about the healthcare system, and there are many factors contributing to costs. And we don't want to overstate the impact of immigration on it. But it's certainly true that much of the growth in the prior to Obamacare and that is unsafe care for illegal immigrants. That's for sure.
It's very expensive, cost shifting, which means hospitals are taking care of people for free and they have to recoup that cost. Otherwise, is the least efficient way to fund healthcare. So let's crack down on that and see where we stand. Dr. Steve Camerata, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. Thanks for joining us today. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. We'll be right back with more of the Alan Nathan Show.
Would you know where to turn if you or loved one suddenly became paralyzed? Paralysis isn't something you plan for, but the National Paralysis Resource Center has served as a vital lifeline for thousands of families. But federal funding for the program is at risk. Marine veteran Sherman Gillums Jr., Senior Director of Public Policy at the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, says the consequences could be devastating.
This is about more than just a budget line. It's about veterans, caregivers, and families, real people who need these resources to live more productive and independent lives.
Gillums, who lives with paralysis himself, says cutting this funding would remove critical resources like peer mentoring, help with housing, and job placement guidance.
When you take away these lifelines, people must figure out how to rebuild their lives on their own. And that's not something any family should have to do.
Learn about the importance of funding for the National Paralysis Resource Center at ChristopherReeve.org.
On Sunday, November 2nd, Americans will fall back to standard time, despite growing concerns over the health and safety risks of seasonal time changes. According to sleep experts, making standard time permanent could improve the lives of millions, and the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time and its partner, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, are working to make that a reality. Dr. Karen Johnson, sleep medicine physician and co-chair of the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time.
When our schedules align with the timing of natural light, people benefit from brighter mornings, safer commutes to work and school, and improved sleep at night.
Want to lessen the effects of the time change? Try these tips. Get at least 7 hours of sleep per night before and after the change. Adjust the timing of daily routines like meals and exercise, and head out for early morning sunlight during the week after the time change. For more information about ending daylight saving time and to find additional resources about sleep disorders, treatments, and sleep health, visit sleepeducation.org, sponsored by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking, but no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times? When we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart and don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
You know that feeling? Like every door is closing and you just can't see a way out? Being unemployed, underemployed, or just out of school feels a lot like that. But when you find the right tools, suddenly everything just clicks. Getting on that path may be easier than you think. A good place to start? Go to findsomethingnew.org. At findsomethingnew.org, you have access to resources that help develop new skills. Skills that will position you for careers in today's growing industries. From healthcare and manufacturing to cybersecurity and alternative energy.
Plus, you can take advantage of online courses, certification programs, apprenticeships, and more. So you can take yourself from unemployed and uncertain to empowered and prepared for what's next. Find your path to a new career today. Visit findsomethingnew.org. A message from the Ad Council.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair, and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something?
It's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all got to help each other right now. We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're going to be saving our lives.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. The rise of Zoran Mamdani over in New York has led to a lot of talk about how campus leftism is bubbling ever more forcefully into American politics. You have politicians who seem like they just walked out of a campus fever swamp, and you have a lot of their voters, a lot of the people propelling them to power, are college-educated kids who are despairing about their future and are unfortunately willing to give communism and socialism one more chance at delivering utopia. Here with us to talk about it is John Tamney, editor of Real Clear Markets, president of the Parkview Institute, a senior fellow at the Market Institute, and author of the book Deficit Delusion, Why Everything Left, Right, and Supply Side Tells You About the National Debt is Wrong. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Now, it's true that there's been campus influence in politics for a long time. No surprise there, because college-educated people tend to go on to become business, cultural, and political leaders. But it seems like it's more pronounced than ever that we're looking at people like Mamdani, and this is the kind of campaign he ran that only makes sense in a college staff room, like a faculty room, at 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody's drunk. Like, that was his entire campaign. It seems like academic leftism run wild.
Yes, and there's no embracing the leftism or any of the things that you described, but I would submit to you that if you and I were running the United States, that there would be many multiples of Mamdani. As I see it, it's where there's lots of wealth, there are people there to demagogue it. We'd never have heard of Mamdani if New York City were poor or impoverished or going down. But naturally, we hear about lots of these people where wealth is created. And so I choose to look at it optimistically. Young people get to be ridiculous in the United States precisely because we're a great country that allows for people to be foolish for a time. But I don't think it describes where young people are going.
Now, one of the problems about this demagoguery is you got to have an office, and there's always been demagogues, and they've said the same thing forever. It all depends who's listening. And what you really have here is an audience of younger people who have come out of the university, and they can't quite articulate it, but they've been swindled. They didn't get the education they thought they were going to get. They don't have the job possibilities they were promised. They're not going to walk right into six-figure jobs and have this cushy lifestyle. And they're angry about it. They're hearing stories now that there won't be any jobs left after AI gets finished with them. And they're looking for somebody to make them feel more comfortable about the future. And along comes the communist guy that says, oh, you'll get free everything and you'll be fine.
Well, yeah, sure. But I would just say that's as old as mankind. I graduated from college in the early 1990s. And they made movies about my generation, Slacker, Reality Bites, Singles. There was a book about Generation X, about how we were going to live lesser lives than our parents, live in their basements, sold shirts at the Gap. To me, this is just the same as ever. Nothing new here. It's what they always say. Watch out for Generation Z, the allegedly communist generation that has no opportunity and is going to become the richest generation in the history of the United States, the richest country in the history of the world, until the next generation comes along and eclipses them.
I just don't think – I think this is a story, but it's a story in a movie that we've seen many times before.
I'm part of the today's generation, too. And, of course, I can remember the anxiety of getting out of school and wondering what the future would hold for me. So in a lot of ways, you're right. I mean, the kids today are the same as we were when we were kids. And it's always hard to tell younger people that it's going to get different when you get older. Just be patient. But I do think there are some differences here. And one of them is that I think our generation, I think that 80s crowd, we had a kind of a belief that we were going to have to pay our dues. We were going to start at the bottom. We were going to work our way. And too many of the young people coming out of colleges today think they're going to walk right into superstar career positions in some of the stuff they were taught in school and some of these softer DEI type subjects. And that's just not the real world. They get out of school and find out that nothing they learned is all that useful or marketable.
Well, but when has it ever been useful or marketable? I mean, honestly, school by definition is teaching yesterday's news. And the U.S. is the most dynamic economy in the world precisely because we relentlessly push the past into the past. And I would just say, the minute you can find me a generation, a young generation in the U.S. that's not entitled, that's when I would tell you we have a crisis, because they would have been conditioned to expect less. In the United States, all we know is progress, so is it any surprise that we appear entitled when we're young? Things just keep getting better. I'll bring up, there's a pamphlet that's given out to this day called Message to Garcia. It's written by a businessman lamenting young people and how don't even bother trying communism on them. They're so lazy, they don't even work for themselves, let alone for other people. When was this pamphlet written? 1899. It was written about the grandparents of the greatest generation. This is nothing new. It's an you want to see kids that aren't entitled, go to Africa, go to the Congo. They are living less than their grandparents and parents lived, and they've got no expectations. Of course we think it should be great for us, because that's all we know. But we eventually create the greatness. Each generation eclipses the one before it. Watch out for these alleged communists in Generation Z. They are going to kill it, as we always do in the United States.
I do think the younger people will be much better off than they think they will, and that's always true. But one other thing about my generation in the 80s was that there was also a sense of optimism and ambition back there. And, you know, it was caricatured as greed. The 80s were the decade of greed is good and all of that. But what have they got now? You know, what's really replaced that? What ambition is filling the people who have just racked up hundreds of thousands of dollars in college debt that they're never going to be able to pay off, and they're looking at the job market out there? Where's the ambition? Where's the hope for the future for these kids?
Well, the hope for the future is that precisely because AI and other technologies are destroying the work of the past, these kids will get to do jobs exponentially more associative with their unique skills, intelligence that our generation got to. Work gets better and better all the time. And I would just add to you, markets are a look ahead. If it were true that young people were really embracing communism and they're just giving up and are just lazy and all this stuff, don't you think that would reflect in crashing stock markets to reflect the fact that the U.S. was turning away from the dynamism and growth that's always defined it? But we're seeing the exact opposite. And who is it that's writing all this AI software and changing the world with AI businesses right now? It's young dropouts from these colleges that allegedly create communists. It's young people doing this. Out in San Francisco right now, that hotbed of liberalism, what's the work ethic out there right now? It's 9-9-6, 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, or 9-9, 6 days a week.
Yes, that's true, and it is going to be younger people driving the technologies of the future. They, like every generation in the modern era, are going to face the challenge of taking disruptive technologies and finding ways to make productive new innovations with them instead of everything being a disaster. So hopefully they'll find some optimism and maybe a little inspiration in looking back at how the last generation did it. John Tamney, editor of Real Clear Markets, president of the Parkview Institute, and author of Deficit Delusion, Why Everything Left, Right, and Supply Side Tells You About the National Debt is Wrong. I'm John Hayward. Thanks for joining us on this hour of the Alan Nathan Show.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.